Sunday, 4th August, 1974. In order that man may be creative, his mind has to come to maturity. It has to be even. To be creative mentally necessitates a mind that is balanced, poised, always at peace within itself. This is the meaning of the controlled mind. Controlled not in the sense of being compelled to be this, that, or the other, but the mind which is naturally at peace and in harmony within itself. Take the body, for example. As long as the body is healthy, the body is at peace within itself. It is harmonious. It is controlled within itself. It performs all its functions, its duties, quite naturally, unself-consciously. Now, that is not the case with the mind. The mind is immature. It is uncontrolled. And it is especially the surface part of the mind which undergoes this disturbance. When this surface disturbance of the mind, this movement helter-skelter, as the result of any and every stimulus, either from without or from within, this helter-skelter aspect of the surface mind is what prevents the mind from being mature, from being healthy. Hence, our disturbed and confused state, which means that we are not fully human. The fully human person is harmonious in his body, is harmonious in his mind. Now, it is quite natural to ask, well, how do I become harmonious in mind? Can I do anything about making the mind harmonious? When I say that, when I ask that question, I naturally look to some criterion, some standard. Ah, this is the harmonious mind. This is the healthy mind. This is the hallmark of humanity. But if I already know that, if I already have a fixed criterion in front of me, then I needn't ask the question. I just get on with the job. Just as in our ordinary physical life, in our everyday duties and so forth, we know what has to be done. You want to cook a meal, we'll say. Very well, you know precisely what you want to cook. And if you can cook at all, you cook. And there's the meal. And that's that. You don't ask, how do I do it? You see? So that one does not need to ask the question if one is looking for a criterion. You don't want a criterion. Besides, this harmony of the mind, like the harmony of the body, is a question of growth, of natural growth. It's not a mechanical thing. We human beings, throughout the world and throughout the centuries, have become so accustomed to the routine of life and to the mechanical aspect of our daily life, that we naturally slide into this pitfall of thinking that, we want a technique, a method, by which the mind will be made healthy. You can't make it healthy. You can let it grow into its full healthy condition. Just as the wise parent lets the child grow, the baby grow, and serves the infant in the way that is just helping it forward. Or if you like, a gardener with his seed. He just plants the seed in the right sort of soil, lets it have water, air, light, warmth, whatever is necessary, and then he lets it grow. He doesn't start fiddling with it, trying to make it into the sort of plant he thinks it ought to be. Now, this is our task with ourselves. And it's curious how we can apply this to the plant kingdom with some considerable skill. And with respect to ourselves, we just cannot do anything about it. Practically nothing about it. Then, first of all, let us bear in mind very carefully that the religious life is not different from the secular life. That is, it is in the daily life, the secular life, that religiousness has its field of growth and expression. Now you may say, but surely the man who lives religiously in the deeply understood, even in the deeply understood sense of the word, is a man apart. He is not like ordinary people. So it seems. If you get a good gardener and he produces a perfect rose, or lovely apples on an apple tree without any blight or worms or whatever it is, you see, then that rose, that apple, is certainly something apart from the ordinary rose or apple. So in that sense, we may say that the religious man is a man apart from ordinary men. But have we ever thought of putting it the other way around? That the religious man is really the ordinary, normal, human man. Put it that way. And if we put it that way, we shall see that that those who are called ordinary people really are subhuman. We are not up to, we are not in the normal human condition, the happily creative condition, the condition in which the mind is harmonious, at peace, naturally, spontaneously, controlled from within itself. So now, if we are subhuman, here is something we can investigate. Now, why is it that we can investigate this far more effectively, successfully, than we can investigate what it means to be truly human? Because the truly human is something very much unknown to us. It's something strange. We don't know it. What sort of a fellow is this? But we do know what we are like. I get angry, I get upset. I react to every stimulus that comes in this, that or the other way. The mind is at the mercy of every stimulus that it receives, pleasant or unpleasant. That I know, don't I? I know that I hate, that I have greed, that I am under delusion, I have delusions, that I daydream instead of attending to the immediate now, the practical thing. And the now is the only reality. It is right here, at this very moment, this split second, that you are conscious. The second before, you were conscious, that's finished, that's dead. The very next split moment which is arriving is not yet here. But here in this very moment, you are awake. Now, do we remain wholly attentive to that? We don't. Why? Because the mind is full of its corpses. It's like a box full of corpses. The dead past, the impressions which have not been worked out, the things which we want to keep hold of and preserve as in a museum, art gallery, I don't mean we shouldn't have art galleries, but you know what I mean. You see, we tend to fossilize that which ought to be allowed to remain totally alive now. Give the living a chance. Get rid of the dead and let the dead bury the dead, as Jesus said. Very, very practically and commonsensically. So now, we know what subhumanity means. What is our first reaction if we are seriously concerned with the art of living, with the art of flowering out into our true humanity? What is our first concern then? We want to get rid of that which we see as sub within ourselves. But is this not precisely the mistake we make? Supposing I'm an ill-tempered person, can I just get rid of my ill temper? How do I get rid of it? Supposing I have a rotten apple in my basket of apples, I can throw it into the dustbin. Right. Now, I have a rotten characteristic inside me. Into which dustbin am I going to throw it, and how? How do I affect this throwing out of a rotten part of me? The part for which I have an aversion. Can I? I've got an earache. All right, can I take my ear and throw it away? Now you see, we don't really appreciate the significance of these things. We don't understand them. The mind is so conditioned by the mechanics of our daily life that we think that just as we can throw objects away, we can get rid of something which is undesirable, as we call it, or unhealthy within ourselves. Well, we can't. We can only heal it. Now again, we suffer from various difficulties. We are so conditioned by our ordinary experience. If the body gets ill, we immediately run to a doctor, which of course is the sensible part of the story. And he writes something which is abracadabra to us, and we take it in great faith and with a heart at rest that now I shall be perfectly well, we take the stuff that is given in bottles and swallow it. That is our concept of healing. All right, we get rid of the symptom. But I still go on overeating, gorging myself with sweets and filling myself with bottles of what, rum, whiskey, I don't touch the darn stuff, but you know what I mean. And then we go to the doctor again. This is our concept of healing. Some of us have studied these matters. Some of us are doctors by profession and so forth. And we will very learnedly lecture to our classes and so on. One of the important characteristics of the living cell is its power of self-healing. Having said those words, we live completely contrary to that fact. Therefore, in truth, we do not know the fact at all. We wholly contradict it with our daily living process. So, I can't heal the psyche by doping it in any way whatsoever, whether it be by means of a physical drug or by means of the professional psychotherapist or whatever it is. It can't be done that way. How then do I do it? That question should be put in another form. How then do I allow the healing process to take place? Because just as the cells, the living cells of the living body, have the power of self-healing, the psyche has the power of righting itself. How do I let it happen? Consider what happens with every manifestation of what is subhuman in us. There is a disturbance, isn't it? A tremendous surface disturbance to start with, and if it becomes sufficiently strong and provocative, it goes right into the depths. It's a state of disturbance. Now, what constitutes the healing of the mind? The cessation of the disturbed state. How does the cessation of the disturbed state take place? How do I let it take place? This is the key to the whole thing, and this is the very difficult part. By looking at it, by just observing it. And it's very difficult to observe it in the right way. Observe it quietly, without criticism. Criticism either for or against that which is being observed. No raising up of excuses for the disturbance. No condemnation of it. No attempt to repress it. And don't let's be under the delusion, oh, it's much better to let off steam and explode away, and then everything is once again happy and so forth in the garden. Yes, of course, it's happy for a few moments, and when the next storm comes, it's much worse than ever. Always. Don't you ever kid yourself that you can get rid of psychical difficulties by just exploding. You don't. You get worse and worse. as the years go by. So one has to observe in the right way. Just stay put and look at it. Just look at it. Don't be anxious to find out reasons why this is the case. Just watch. And in the watching, the mind will see the truth of the matter insofar as the mind has the ability, the capacity to see the truth. Now, as the mind sees the truth of the matter, naturally, to the extent that it is capable of doing so, it grows in the power to see the truth. It has to come from within. It is your mental eyes which have to see. And if your mental eyes are weak, well then you will see only a little bit. You can't see more than that. Supposing somebody tells you what is the truth of the matter, what happens? An impression is made on the surface layer of your brain cells, and you say, ah, yes, that's it, I've got it. Well, what have you got? A bundle of words. That is all. You've got a bundle of words which are not even as effective as the doctor's physical pills on the body. You don't see the truth that way. That is not seeing the truth. When you see the truth, you will notice in your own life experience that it is always accompanied by the power to live that truth. That is the meaning of seeing the truth. You can now do it. You know how Plato taught that you don't know anything unless and until you can naturally and easily do what you say you know. An extraordinarily profound teaching. Plato was a supremely religious man in the grand sense of the term, one of the few philosophers who was. He was not a mere armchair intellectual speculator. He lived the life. So you see, when you really see from within yourself something, right, then you are able to that extent to live it. And as you live it, just as the body grows by exercise, by utilizing its muscles, it grows in strength and skill and ability and all that of it, the mind similarly grows from within all the time. What another person says may be a stimulus which makes you feel, ah, that's it. And when you feel, ah, that's it, it means that that which was hidden inside, just waiting to come up to the conscious level, has come up to the conscious level, and it is part of your vision. It is definitely part of your vision. Because you will notice that when you say that, yes, that's it, there is a certain of course-ness about it. Oh, yes, of course, you've seen it. There's no mistaking it. So that means that the mind is growing in the ability to see the truth. Now that is one aspect of the situation. One important aspect of it, seeing the truth, in order to heal the illness of the psyche. But that's not enough. Just as a physical medicine, when required, an external medicine, is taken into you, you must take into you that which you have seen. I have a bad temper, we'll say, since I started with ill-temperedness. will keep to ill-temperedness. I have a bad temper. Now, I've seen the thing like that objectively, as I say, you see. But whatever is seen objectively tends to remain outside me. It is only external. An effect has already been produced within by the act of the mind which is within me, seeing that as truth. And to that degree, it helps to heal the psyche. But if the healing is to be a real healing, I must take in completely that which is seen. Now you see, this sounds very strange. You say, good heavens, are you suggesting that you should take in that which you see as evil? Yes, indeed. What do I mean by taking in that which is evil? Where the psyche is concerned, the evil is not outside me. It is in. But the intellect has performed the task of objectivizing it and projecting it in front of the logical, intellectual, analytical process. Now, you recognize this is in me. You really recognize it. You don't merely say, oh, I am an ill-tempered fellow because you have suffered from the unhappy effects of a burst of ill-temper. But now you really take it in you in this sense that, yes, this is here. Now what will heal? What's the next step in the healing process? If I have aversion for it, dislike of it, hatred against it, I shall remain in a state of conflict. If I am stupid enough, sometimes wicked enough, to flaunt it for various reasons, and many people have the egoism and vanity to do that sort of thing, to flaunt their evil tendencies, in order that they get a certain sort of a, he's a real Don Juan. And they make profit out of it, you see. If he's that sort, he certainly won't be healed, and he's as irreligious can be. But if you're really serious and concerned, and you see that this is in you yourself, and you understand it fully, yes, and maintain that inner poise, that quietude, then the vestiges of ill temper begin to vanish. That is to say, they don't disappear out of the window or some such thing, or get thrown into some psychical dustbin. They don't. But they get transformed in your own nature. And the transformation shows itself, the sign of that transformation is that whatever the provocation may be, there won't be the reaction of ill temper out of you. You are awake. You are healed. You are whole. Now you see, this is always a problem of the extent of the provocation. A very kind, liberal, generous nature, a person who suffers a lot, endures fools, not gladly, but with infinite patience and forbearance and that sort of thing. Up to a point he will do it, then there will come a breaking point, possibly. Well, if the breaking point comes, then I know I am subhuman. Still subhuman in this respect, or that respect. But if, under any provocation, the breaking point does not come, then I am truly human at last. The psyche is healed. Don't let us have any illusions. This task is not easy. this task never ends. And it never ends because our milieu, whatever it is in the world, is always throwing stimuli at us which are provocative. And remember, each one of us is but a tiny little fragment of all humanity. One reason for reducing the population: each one of us is only 1/4,000,000,000th part of humanity. And the other 3,999,999,999 are all sending out stimuli into the injecting stimuli into the psychical atmosphere, which keeps impinging on each one of us. We mustn't forget that. You see? So the task is not at all easy. And it will never end, for the simple reason that always there is this influx of very bad, foul psychical weather conditions which we constantly have to deal with. See? And of course, where the psychical weather conditions are concerned, it is quite impossible to put on Macintoshes and open up umbrellas. When the storm comes, you just have to get wet. Or, in a good many instances, you just have to blaze through. We have to be very practical, very matter-of-fact, and see this as a living fact. And this applies to every aspect of our lives. Every aspect. In some form or other. So that it is an endless task, an immeasurable task. And it is important to appreciate this aspect of immeasurability. For this very simple reason: conditioned as we are with the mechanics of our ordinary life process, our life activities, we have a tendency to measure everything. When will the job end? When will it be finished and I won't have to work anymore? No, you have to work all day and every day for all your life. And there is no pension afterwards. Absolutely none. So don't measure. How far have I progressed? This wretched word progress is misapplied in the intellectual, psychical, spiritual sphere. Progress has meaning only in mechanical terms. In terms of the acquisition of knowledge, of skills, of techniques, of better techniques to produce a needed result, and so forth. That's all. But it has no meaning in terms of you and I as human beings. There is no meaning to it. Because, you see, it implies a criterion, a standard. What is the standard you are going to set up? The Buddha? Krishna? Jesus Christ? Ramana Maharishi? Or anybody you like to name, anybody and everybody you like to name, a film star, or a pop singer popping away till your eardrums split. You see? You're going to set up a standard. Do you think that you can become like that standard? You never will. quite impossible. You are you. It's an extraordinary delusion and an extraordinary folly and an extraordinary shirking of personal responsibility to be yourself. But God help you if you make a picture of what you yourself ought to be. Then you make a caricature of yourself. Be free from within. Be unburdened of all these, this mountain load of foolish ideas and conceptions, misconceptions all along the line. Let them all go. And then the mind will be able to breathe freely, fresh air, open air. Breathe the air of the spirit, which is the source of life and power and beauty and goodness and truth. And you will find that all these things will naturally emerge from within your own being. Because within ourselves is locked up the totality which we can put under one name, divinity itself. I'll quote Eckhart. And I quote Eckhart here for the simple reason that he was the member of a faith, he was a Christian, which distinctly presents God, the Supreme Being, as a wholly other than man, the creature, the created, the creator. God is absolutely wholly other. And Eckhart said, "For man verily is God, and God verily is man." The whole of divinity is enshrined in each and every one of us. Enshrined. It is our potentiality. Our personal responsibility is to let it emerge. Scholars and intellectuals and religious philosophers glibly talk about the immanence and the immanent God and the transcendent God and so on. They make all these lovely pictures, which are very lovely, very interesting indeed. We all have to go through that stage in our lives, especially in our young days, when the intellect must necessarily revel in these things. I did. And I was as greedy intellectually as the greediest intellectual guzzler that ever was. You can take all these things in, but bear in mind, they pass away. What you eat must be digested. Part of it will be assimilated and the remainder rejected, or the doctor comes in. So you see, this divinity is enshrined in us. What does it mean? Divinity, is it, you think it's something else which is locked away somewhere, which might be found out by modern endoscopic methods? Not a bit of it. It is a case of yourself, of myself, awakening to the fact of myself, of yourself. It is a case of awakening to that. And it is this awakening which is the fundamental meaning of religious flowering and the fruition of the religious being inside you. It is this awakening. And this awakening, when completed, when come to its fullness, and when it remains at its fullness, means that the mind is perfectly harmonious, it is perfectly healthy. That body and psyche are truly a living psychophysical organism worthy of the name man, the human being, the happy creator.